of his mother. The Palestinian Ministry of Health reported that Israeli snipers killed another three Palestinians at the hospital on the same day.
How many more children? Gaza, October 7th. The sun is coming up. Boats are moving up and down in the cool sea breeze. Seagulls flying over the beach. The law before the storm. Suddenly, a bulldozer breaks the Israeli-built fence around Gaza. No one really knows what is happening. In no time, fighters from Gaza take control of the Beit Hanun crossing. A land, air, and sea attack into the heart of Israeli-occupied territories. Palestinian forces attack military installations and take over various settlements. The Israelis in the Sharon Plain wake up to the blare of sirens. They're caught off guard. Danger is around the corner. They don't expect their holiday to be ruined like that. Israel describes the operation as an unprovoked attack, blaming Hamas for disturbing the peace in the region. In the United States, politicians echo the same narrative. Former U.S. President George W. Bush calls Hamas cold-blooded killers.
This was an unprovoked attack by terrorist people willing to kill innocent people to achieve an objective. And don't be surprised if Israel takes whatever action is necessary to defend herself. And it's going to be ugly for a while. You're dealing with cold-blooded killers.
But is the Palestinian group's operation really an unprovoked attack? And isn't there anything surprising about it?
Let me show you a map of the Middle East.
Just a couple of weeks before Hamas launched Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had unveiled his future map of the region at the United Nations General Assembly. The map had no place for Palestinians, and Israel still included the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as well as the occupied and illegally annexed Golan Heights of Syria. The little map was in fact the blueprint for the complete elimination of Palestine from the region for the sake of the so-called Greater Israel. Israel's prolonged policy of ignoring Palestinians' rights as a nation is clearly reflected in its illegal settlement projects. Built on usurped territories, these settlements and their cancerous expansion have dashed Palestinians' hopes for establishing their own state and ending their lingering limbo as a nation under occupation. In recent years, the Israeli regime has put settlement expansion at the top of its priorities. In one of the recent cases, Netanyahu passed a controversial resolution in June 2023 and gave a carte blanche to his cabinet to construct more settlements in the occupied West Bank. One month later, the head of the Regional Council for West Bank Settlements, Yossi Dagan, submitted a proposal to Netanyahu to increase the number of Jewish settlers in the northern West Bank from 170,000 to 1 million by 2050. There are already over 700,000 Israeli settlers living in 176 settlements and 186 so-called outposts in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds. All of these settlements and outposts, and the settlers who live in them, are illegal under international law. Since occupying the West Bank and Gaza, Israel has unilaterally declared tens of thousands of hectares of a so-called state land for Israeli settlements. Mushrooming across Palestine, these illegal settlements have made life excruciatingly difficult for Palestinian communities, aggravating their already dire situation. In addition to depriving the families of a home, which is the main asset and source of mental, physical, and economic security, the settlement building and its concomitant evictions of Palestinians frequently result in the loss of livelihoods and expansion of poverty. These settlements always come with the uprooting of Palestinian trees, destruction of their cultivated land, and discriminatory management of water resources in favor of the settlers. To make life even more difficult, restrictions have been imposed on Palestinian movement and access to resources. The Israeli regime has set up checkpoints, barriers, and separation walls that drastically limit the freedom of movement for Palestinians. This has had a profound impact on their daily lives. It affects movement within parts of the occupied Palestinian territories between the West Bank and Gaza, as well as between occupied Palestinian territories and the rest of the world. Since 2007, Gaza has been subjected to a crippling blockade, which has caused immense suffering and a humanitarian crisis. The food supply is also limited by the siege. From 2007 to 2010, Israeli authorities kept a calorie count of Palestinians' nutritional needs to narrowly avoid malnutrition while restricting access to food for the people in Gaza. Today, according to the World Food Program, a significant portion of the population is food insecure. In 2022, 1.84 million people across Palestine, one-third of the population, did not have enough food to eat. Among these people, 1.1 million were considered severely food insecure, 90% of whom lived in Gaza. The Strip also suffers from an energy crisis. The Israeli ban on the entry of fuel into Gaza means that electricity production is severely limited. In 2023, before the Hamas-Israel escalation, Gaza had only 13 hours of electricity a day. The blockade has also taken a toll on the Strip's medical facilities. Hospitals lack basic supplies, equipment, and infrastructure, and are unable to handle severe cases or provide proper care for the chronically ill. The blockade also has crippled the economy, leading to high unemployment rates and widespread poverty. With nearly half of the population out of job, the Gaza Strip has one of the highest unemployment rates in the world. Data also indicate that more than 80% of the Gazans live in poverty. The blockade has turned the territory into an open-air prison where the residents have no place to go, no job to do, and no hope to cling to. According to the UNRWA report published in August 2023, for at least the last decade and a half, the socioeconomic situation in Gaza has been in steady decline. Israel's inhumane behavior usually takes even a harsher form. The regime's military operations in Gaza have led to high civilian casualties and widespread infrastructure damage. The destruction of homes, schools, and hospitals has left countless Palestinians dead, displaced, or in desperate need of assistance. Just within the period of a few weeks since October 7th, over 10,000 Palestinians have lost their lives, including over 4,100 children. In fact, in every action the Israeli regime takes, there is one recurring feature: lack of respect for Palestinian lives. From 2008 till September 2023, 6,407 Palestinians were recorded to have been killed by the Israeli regime, more than half through missile attacks. Targeting Al Ahli Hospital in Gaza on October 17th that killed more than 500 Palestinians was the very epitome of the regime's brutality. At the same time, Tel Aviv is also accused of using white phosphorus in its military onslaught on Gaza. The banned substance puts civilians at risk of serious and long-term injuries. As a weapon, white phosphorus has a significant incendiary effect that can severely burn people and set structures, fields, and other civilian objects in the vicinity on fire. Israel's use of the deadly chemical violates international norms. Prior to October 7th, there were about 5,200 Palestinians in Israeli prisons, kept under dangerous prison conditions. Of this number, nearly 2,000 were condemned to life sentences on trumped-up charges. Palestinian prisoners are subjected to torture, starvation, and thirst, while being prevented from accessing their medicine. Israel is using different legal pretexts to withhold the detainees from different areas. Palestinians from the Gaza Strip who were arrested inside Israel are being held under the Unlawful Combatants Law, which allows authorities to detain Palestinians indefinitely without effective judicial review. The law defines an unlawful combatant as a person who has participated either directly or indirectly in hostile acts against Israel or is a member of a force perpetrating hostile acts against Israel. On October 13th, Israel amended the law to make it easier to arrest Palestinians on mere suspicion. The unlawful combatant law is the equivalent of the so-called administrative detention in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds, which allows Israel to hold Palestinians from those areas indefinitely under secret evidence, practically meaning under no evidence. The number of prisoners has now risen to more than 10,000 people. Since October 7th, Israel has arrested some 4,000 laborers from Gaza and more than 1,000 people in the occupied West Bank. Just a few days before Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, thousands of settlers carried out provocative tours of the mosque complex, following calls by extremist Jewish groups. Since the occupation of the East Al-Quds in 1967, Tel Aviv has allowed Israeli extremists to intimidate and violate the sanctity of the mosque. Under the so-called status quo agreement, only Muslims are allowed to pray inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Entering the mosque with boots on, beating worshippers, firing bullets and grenades, as well as vandalizing the site, have become common scenes in Al-Aqsa, the third holiest place for Muslims. In just 1 year, between September 2021 and September 2022, nearly 50,000 right-wing Jews raided Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's only part of the systematic Israeli campaign to Judaize Al-Quds. Against such a backdrop, the betrayal of the Palestinian cause by some Arab states in the form of the so-called Abraham Accords in 2022 and rumors that Saudi Arabia was just following suit could be regarded as the last straw. The normalization of ties between major Arab states and the Israeli regime sends shockwaves through the occupied territories. Forgotten by the international community, betrayed by Arab brothers and oppressed by the brutal regime of Israel, Palestinians are left with two hard choices: to give up the homeland altogether or to die for it. There is nothing surprising that Operation Al-Aqsa Flood was launched from Gaza. It is an impoverished, congested place inhabited largely by Palestinian refugees expelled from their homes during the Nakba of 1948. Gaza has also been under a debilitating siege for years, which has taken a heavy toll on its people. In fact, what appears to be the largest military response by Palestinians in decades is an inevitable development, an act of resistance and a reaction to the suffering of the nation under a brutal blockade and occupation. It is part of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. The struggle for freedom is, however, an uphill battle. The Israeli regime, in blind rage, has undertaken a new episode of mass killing of civilians. Israel is carpet bombing Gaza. Telecommunications infrastructure has been bombarded, effectively cutting off Palestinians in Gaza from the rest of the world. Tel Aviv has imposed a full blockade on Gaza, with no water, electricity, food, or medicine entering the strip. Meanwhile, the West Bank has been completely blocked. Checkpoints closed all across, paralyzing the whole territory. Israeli soldiers are shooting Palestinians and encouraging settlers to do so as well. Genocide is in the making. Israeli jets will continue to pound Gaza as long as the Gazans' hearts continue to pound for their land. But how many more Palestinians have to get killed? How many more men? How many more women? And how many more children? Life has lost its meaning for the Palestinians, who have been stripped of their homeland. So the only thing they care about is taking back their stolen land, their own land. That's the red line drawn by their blood.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Through both their statements and their silence, leading European thinkers have exposed Western racism. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, En Berara is an Israeli expression that is used to depict the persistent destruction, ethnic cleansing, and now genocide of indigenous Palestinians as acts of self-defense for which there is no alternative. The International Court of Justice recently affirmed the real and imminent risk arising from South Africa's allegations that the Zionist regime is committing genocide in Gaza. This did not unfold in a vacuum. Such outcomes are inherent to the settler colonial structure of elimination imposed on Palestine by Euro-American imperialism. As detailed in South Africa's application to the ICJ, decades of Israeli colonialism led to the state reaching its genocidal moment. In 2006, Patrick Wolf, a distinguished scholar of settler colonialism, considered genocide to be plausible in Palestine. He saw compelling indications of genocidal dynamics through the Zionist regime holding the Palestinian population captive in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. Although universally recognized as the crime of all crimes, genocide represents just one of many atrocious manifestations of settler colonial violence, which is leveraged to seize land and dispossess indigenous owners. There is an army of not just troops, but also philosophers, ethicists, who moralize and justify colonialism as acts of embrera, or no choice. This notion is deeply entrenched in Euro-modern colonial knowledge, which has criminalized and deprived colonized peoples of ontological resistance so that their souls, psyches, and identities can be reshaped to suit the colonizers' schemes, as Franz Fanon reminds us in Black Skin, White Masks. This mechanism of self-vindication denies colonized people the rights to self-defense and resistance to preserve and reclaim their humanity. Instead, it transfers guilt onto the victims. The Spanish conquistadors considered the deaths and calamities they inflicted on the indigenous peoples of South America as their own fault for standing in the invaders' way. Philosopher George Hegel asserted that Africans were guilty because of their innate contempt for humanity, which made them susceptible to being shot down by thousands in war with Europeans. Similarly, the Zionist regime holds Palestinians condemnable for having forced Zionist settlers to kill them, as suggested by former Zionist regime Prime Minister Golda Meir. In the 21st century, leading European thinkers associated with the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory insist on reminding us of the indivisibility of European modern ethics and coloniality. Jürgen Habermas, a prominent European philosopher, and others expressed solidarity with the Zionist regime in mid-November while genocide was clearly unfolding in Gaza. Habermas based his stance on the contrived accusation that the resistance group Hamas intends to eliminate Jewish life in general, implying that the Zionist regime had no choice but to retaliate in the manner it has. The resistance group Hamas, which is proscribed as a terrorist group in the UK and other Western regimes, has on several occasions affirmed that it does not wage a struggle against the Jews because they are Jewish, but wage a struggle against the Zionists who occupy Palestine. Other critical philosophers, including Celia Benhabib, have echoed the Zionist regime's allegations on the killings of babies, burning people alive, and ritual murder, which have been debunked as fabricated propaganda. Truth, facts, proof, objectivity, context, and history apparently have no place when Euro-colonial interests are at stake. Amid the clamor of dehumanization, Palestinians, like all colonized people, have been stripped of their rights on the ontological resistance and self-defense. Palestinian life has come into conflict with white supremacy and the West's desire to atone for its own anti-Semitism and the genocide of European Jews. Consequently, Palestinians have become the embodiment of the damned of the earth of the 21st century, literally forced out through genocide and ethnic cleansing. Both Palestinians and Jews were singled out in the statement by Habermas and his colleagues. While the latter were deemed worthy of a special protection, the former was silenced and removed from the sphere of human dignity and concerns about the democratic ethos of the West. This represents two faces of the same racist and dehumanizing idea that has historically pitted supposedly inferior groups, including Jews and Muslims, designated as Semitic peoples against the self-declared superior European Aryan race. Evil might have changed its form, but not its racist essence. Palestine is the ethical battleground of our time, where the racism inherent in Euro-modern colonial knowledge is dissected, exposed, and resisted. This knowledge system, whether by justification or through silence, echoes the historical pattern of colonial atrocities across the global South, including the unfolding genocide in Palestine. In this light, as eloquently articulated by ethics professor Wael Hallaq, the Palestinian experience of colonial life and death encapsulates the global issue of ethics and knowledge.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
In late 2023, South Africa filed a case at the International Court of Justice, ICJ, over the Israeli apartheid regime's genocidal war against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. South Africa stated that the Tel Aviv regime has failed to uphold its commitments under the 1948 Genocide Convention. South Africa filed a lawsuit against the Israeli regime at the end of December, noting that Israel's actions in Gaza that started last October are genocidal in character because they are intended to bring about the destruction of a substantial part of the Palestinian national, racial, and ethnic group. Now, the UN Court, in its interim ruling on January the 26th, stated that South Africa's claims are plausible. The court ordered provisional measures that the Israeli regime must implement to prevent genocidal acts and allow humanitarian flow into the Gaza Strip. The Israeli regime has ignored this ruling and continues with its US-backed genocidal war against Palestinians. South Africa has been one of the outspoken critics of the Israeli regime's genocidal war against Palestinians and has led some initiatives to hold this regime accountable for its actions in Gaza. So what are the main factors behind South Africa's long-standing solidarity with Palestine?
South Africa ICJ case against Israel.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and welcome to Africa Today. And this week, we are discussing the ongoing South Africa's genocide case against the Israeli regime at the International Court of Justice, ICJ. Now, the case has drawn the admiration of all freedom seekers worldwide. We have a special guest to discuss the topic today. He's none other than South African Ambassador to Iran, His Excellency Dr. Francis Moloi. Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for your time today.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Mubarak. It's a pleasure to be here.
As we know, many freedom seekers worldwide and people who love peace, they have welcomed South Africa's case against the Israeli apartheid regime at the ICC over its genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. Now, first, can you tell us what was the motivation or the factors behind South Africa's move to initiate this very historical case?
Well, the people of Palestine have been under occupation for over 75 years. And they have not enjoyed the rights and freedoms that we as the world community have proclaimed on, particularly after the Second World War. They have been on the receiving end of Israeli brutality, Israeli violence, violation of human rights and freedoms, denial of rights, and that situation of the Nakba has been continuing since 1948. But what we saw since October last year is unprecedented in recent memory. And when we looked at the totality of what the apartheid government in Israel has done, for us it is a very clear, straightforward, open and shut textbook case of genocide. Because what has happened in Gaza flows directly from the genocidal instructions, genocidal statements that were uttered by the top state functionaries in Israel. And those instructions and statements were carried to the letter by the IDF. And when we look at everything that has happened, every single one of those violations that have been committed fit very neatly the provisions of Article 2 of the Genocide Convention. It is clear that these actions by the Israeli Defense Force are aimed at killing the members of the group, which are the Palestinians, to cause them immense bodily and mental harm. Everything has been you know, done to ensure the total destruction of Palestinian lives. Everything has been done to prevent the births in the Palestinian community. And if you look at that for us, that is a textbook definition of what a genocide is. But why did we decide to go to the ICJ and not any other court? Because, first of all, the ICJ is the only tribunal in the system of international law that has jurisdiction to decide the disputes over genocide. South Africa, as a signatory to the Genocide Convention, like Israel and all other countries, we all have an obligation, a binding obligation under the Genocide Convention to prevent the crime of genocide and to punish it. The other very important consideration that we took into account was that Israel itself is a signatory to the Genocide Convention, and by its signature, it has consented to the jurisdiction of the ICJ over the disputes related to to the crime of genocide. And we as South Africa, by virtue of the fact that we also have an obligation under the Genocide Convention to prevent that crime, we do not need to be a party to the current conflict that's going in there. So we have what lawyers call locus standi in the ICJ, and therefore that gives us you know, that opportunity or that privilege to present this case on behalf of the Palestinians in the ICJ.
And by the way, you know, we remember that after the Rwanda genocide, the world said never again, and it's happening again, unfortunately. So in its ruling, the ICJ issued interim orders that the Israeli regime must you know, take measures to prevent genocide. But I think the regime is intent on continuing its genocidal war backed by the U.S. And, you know, we have seen what is happening in Rafah. So what's your take on this? I mean, it's total impunity on the part of the Israeli regime.
That has been our experience with the apartheid government in Israel for a very long time. They have acted completely with impunity, and they have enjoyed political, diplomatic support and cover from their some of their partners in the West.
Yeah.
And that has been quite unfortunate. Mm-hmm. Now, these provisional measures that the court has ordered, and we must be very clear, those provisional measures are binding on Israel, and they are binding on all of us as far as our obligations to prevent genocide are concerned. So the fact that the court has ordered these measures, there is also a corresponding obligation on all of us to ensure that Israel complies with these orders. For instance, it was really disappointing to see, particularly after the provisional measures were ordered, to see Israel's partners continuing to support Israel through provision of arms. And taking actions like withdrawing funding from UNRWA, the consequence of which is that it will perpetuate the genocidal decision on the part of Israel to starve the people of Gaza of food, medicines, and other essentials. So Israel is under an obligation to comply with these measures. And the rest of us must ensure that Israel complies with this, and that we do not take actions that will continue to perpetuate the genocide that is unfolding in Gaza.
Members of the U.S. Congress have called for, you know, like a review of South Africa-U.S. ties because of your country's stance at the ICC. And, you know, South Africa is resisting and has that resolve to move on. So what do you view all these threats? Have you received other, you know, like threats to downgrade ties or, you know, to pressurize you to withdraw from your support for Palestine?
Yes, we have seen, and you are referring to the United States, we have seen pieces of legislation that have been proposed in this context, as you say, to review our bilateral relations with the U.S.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know exactly what that means, but the U.S.'s own internal legislative processes, those are processes over which we have no control whatsoever. But what I will say, Mubarak, is this, that our decision to take this route is informed by the principles, the norms, the values, the standards that underpin our engagement with the world. At a multilateral level, at a bilateral level. And we, in our foreign policy, we are very clear. We are informed by principles such as respect for human life, multilateralism, the desire to have international relations governed by pre-agreed rules, as opposed to international relations being governed by a brute military and economic and political power. We believe in a system of international relations that respects the rule of international law, that seeks to resolve pressing political conflicts through peaceful means. And we wanted to, in order to ensure that we can live by these principles, we want to ensure that those institutions of global governance, like the United Nations, and those instruments of international legal systems, like the human rights legal systems, international humanitarian law, and all this, that we can use this and rely on this to address the problems that we face in the world. And our approach through the ICJ is simply our desire to work within an agreed framework or so. Mm-hmm. So if other countries think that we shouldn't be doing that, or that if we pursue that that route, we need to be punished, well, it is something that over which we have no control. But what we know that we are fortified in our approach. Yeah. It's a principled approach that we are taking. Impressive. And this is the correct way of approaching it.
Now, and this brings in the issue of double standards, you know, within the international system. You know, like during this conflict, Ukraine-Russia conflict, we've seen the ICC has issued, you know, arrest warrants or summons against Russian President Vladimir Putin. But within 3 or 4 months, the Israeli regime has killed 30,000 Palestinians, most of them women and children. And no warrant of arrest has been issued against the Israeli regime's Prime Minister Netanyahu. What's your take on these double standards?
Mubarak, my brother, you use the term double standards, and you are absolutely right to characterize how some of these international rules have been applied. And that is unfortunate because we cannot have a system of international law that applies or uses different rules and criteria for some and a different set of rules for the other.
Yeah.
That will simply breed contempt for the rules of international law. That will only bring this global system of rules into disrepute.
Yeah.
And it doesn't augur well for the global community going forward.
Yeah.
So it is regrettable that some of these institutions of global governance, and you have referred to the ICC, that in the case of President Putin, and now in the case of Prime Minister Netanyahu and some of the leaders of the apartheid regime in Israel, different set of rules are being applied.
Exactly.
And that is unacceptable. We must have a system of international law that applies to all, because international law must be applied without fear, favor, or prejudice, equally so. And that way you can inspire confidence in these rules.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if we continue to operate on the basis of these double standards, we will not do any good to the international system as a whole.
Yeah. So, Mr. Ambassador, we'll take a short break before we continue our discussion on South Africa's case against the Israeli apartheid regime at the International Court of Justice. Stay with us.
South Africa ICJ case against Israel.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back to Africa Today, and this week we are discussing the ongoing South Africa's genocide case against the Israeli apartheid regime at the International Court of Justice. Welcome back, Mr. Ambassador. Now, Israeli regime officials have accused South Africa of working closely with the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement, Hamas, and even say that South Africa is the legal arm of Hamas. What's your take on these claims?
We heard that, and that was one of the first accusations that Israel made when we took the case up to the ICJ. Mm-hmm. And, well, that is in the strategy of the Israeli government. Mm-hmm. Those that it doesn't agree with, it mm-hmm. will always label them. In our case now, we have been labeled as the legal arm of Hamas.
Yeah.
We have been labeled anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, and, mm-hmm. and all this. And this is a strategy that they use to delegitimize, to pour scorn mm-hmm. over the principled course of action that that we have mm-hmm. we have taken. And these insults, really, and these labels are usually the refuge of someone who does not have a case, and therefore these don't mean anything to us indeed. And I imagine that we are being labeled the legal arm of Hamas because in the eyes of Israel, Hamas is a terrorist organization, so it is regarded, but we do not regard Hamas as a terrorist organization, indeed. And we find those labels and comments mm-hmm. to be utterly preposterous.
Mr. Ambassador, South Africa has also been at the forefront of rejecting attempts by the Israeli apartheid regime to infiltrate the African Union. And the last attempt, two Israeli regime's officials were actually ejected from an AU summit in Addis Ababa. Can we now consider, following this genocide in Gaza, can we now consider that that case is closed and the regime will no longer be considered even for being an observer member of the African Union?
The issue of Israel as an observer in the AU is an issue that our leaders still needed to discuss at the summit level. However, from South Africa's point mm-hmm. of view, we are very clear. We will oppose any decision, any application that seeks to admit Israel as an observer in the AU. And the events since October last year, the genocide that Israel has carried out against the people of Palestine is in fact another solid reason why Israel's attempts to be an observer in the AU ought to be rejected.
Now, we have seen many countries have expressed support, you know, to South Africa's case against the Israeli regime at the ICJ. Now, how will this impact on South Africa in terms of global geopolitics?
Well, yes, we have many countries have expressed the support for South Africa going forward, mm-hmm. which we appreciate, mm-hmm. Of course, and which I think the people of Palestine appreciate. As to how this will impact on geopolitics, I guess this the jury is still out
It's unfolding.
Exactly. But for us, we have this case to prosecute, mm-hmm. We think we have made a very strong case going forward. We have now passed the provisional measures, and we are glad that at the end of the submissions that we made on the 11th of January, mm-hmm. When other countries had labeled our cause of action as meritless, as baseless, as without any basis whatsoever, the ICJ agreed with us mm-hmm. by and large. And we ought now to be moving into the merits stage. And for us, that is what we are focusing on. What are the implications and the broader geopolitics of that mm-hmm. would be, we mm-hmm. leave that to others to deal with.
And now, and even the fact that many state and non-state actors are supporting South Africa's bid, do you think there will be changes in the international you know, system of justice, that there'll be more focus, people will have some hope on this international court of justice and even the ICC? Are we going to see an evolution towards more trust to these institutions?
From where I'm sitting, Mubarak, my brother, I think that this case has awakened the conscience of ordinary people on Main Street. And these protests that we have seen across the world, from Cape Town to London, from Washington, D.C. to Sydney. Ramallah, to all over, the ordinary people on the ground, through their various formations of civil society, have taken this issue upon their shoulders, and they are putting pressure on their governments to do something about the genocide in Gaza. The ceasefire now, the calls for the ceasefire, the calls for humanitarian aid, and the calls for holding the apartheid government in Israel accountable. All this is important, and it's a positive development, because ordinary people on Main Street now realize that these commitments to international law, international principles ought to be implemented. And I think if anything that will come out of this, it is that positive reawakening of the people on the ground.
Now, Mr. Ambassador, BRICS recently expanded to include more countries, including Iran. And it's emerging as a major force globally. What do you think? What role can BRICS play in resolving global conflicts like the current genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza?
Well, BRICS is a grouping of mostly developing countries from the south. And we have common objectives of pulling together our resources to develop our countries, our economies, to develop our people, and to foster greater cooperation and collaboration amongst ourselves. And therefore, our cooperation is in many fields of economy, of politics, of culture, science and technology, and so on and so forth. And we also seek to, you know, adopt common approaches at resolving or addressing questions such as the conflict in Gaza. So BRICS becomes one of the important formations of the countries of the South to deal with all these challenges that we face today.
Mr. Ambassador, South Africa has been at the forefront, you know, of resolving the Palestinian issue. And there have been so many proposals, there have been talks and negotiations that have failed because the Israeli apartheid regime has failed, you know, to implement its commitments. And there is now this proposal, for example. Iran is proposing that one of the ways of, actually one of the main ways of resolving the Palestinian conflict is through having a referendum that will involve all original inhabitants of Palestine, be they Jews, Christians, or Muslims. And even a referendum that will involve all Palestinian refugees who are scattered across the globe. Do you think this is a good solution? What's your take on this proposal to use a referendum to resolve the Palestinian issue?
Yes, so many proposals have been made about how to resolve the question of Palestine. And we respect the sovereign position that the Islamic Republic of Iran has taken. And we cannot contend, we cannot argue with that. It's a sovereign position of the Islamic Republic. But the important thing is that that proposal is also aimed at finding a durable, lasting peace for the people of Palestine. And we acknowledge and we appreciate and we endorse the principled support that Iran has provided to the people of Palestine. And it is part and parcel of that global effort to find accommodation and a solution to this.
Mr. Ambassador, our last question. The South African Parliament took a very decisive decision recalling or the cutting of ties with the Israeli regime and the ejection of the Israeli ambassador from South Africa. And we've seen South Africans have also come out massively, you know, to express support to Palestinians. Can you tell us more about this, the reason why South Africans are also, the people of South Africa, have come out, you know, to express their support to Palestinians?
Yeah, first of all, yes, as South Africa, we support fully the struggle of the people of Palestine, and the people of South Africa on Main Street supported that. However, I will say that, yes, it is true, we have recalled our ambassador from Tel Aviv since, I think, 2018. We have recalled all our diplomatic staff in Tel Aviv, and we have also closed our embassy there. And it's not that we have cut the diplomatic ties as such, but we have just closed our embassy.